sports.com/radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about the Republican tax plan and its impact on health care, Medicare, and Social Security. Well, the Senate began debate on the tax bill this morning at 10 o'clock, with Republicans pushing for a final vote later today. This morning, Senator Steve Daines, Republican of Montana, announced his support of the tax bill. And a spokesperson for another Republican holdout, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, said Johnson also supports the plan. I'm reading this from the New York Times this morning. Yesterday, Republicans picked up the support of Senator John McCain of Arizona, but they faced a setback late yesterday when they were left scrambling to find hundreds of billions of dollars in extra revenue to satisfy concerns about the bill's deficit effects. Lawmakers are now mulling options that would result in a tax increase down the road, including a possible increase in the corporate tax rate and the revival of the alternative minimum tax on wealthy individuals and some companies. The Senate has once again regained momentum to pass the Republican sweeping tax overhaul after the party leaders picked up the votes of the two holdouts, Daines and Johnson. Another wild card is Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, who has pushed hard along with Senator Mike Lee of Utah for an amendment that would allow more low-income families to claim an expanded child tax credit. To fund that change, Mr. Rubio and Mr. Lee would reduce the size of the cut in the corporate tax rate, landing it at 22% instead of 20%, a change opposed by many Republicans and by President Trump. And after spending a year on the failed effort to repeal Obamacare, Republicans on Capitol Hill are on the verge of repealing the law's individual mandate as a footnote to the rewrite of the American tax system. At least two of the three Senate Republicans who blocked the repeal effort over the summer have no problem undoing the requirement that nearly all Americans carry insurance. That's a provision Democrats say is vital to keeping Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act afloat. We're going to talk about the Senate tax plan and the effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act mandate with Wendell Potter, who is a former executive within the health insurance industry, but he left that industry writing several books, including Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. He also wrote the e-book, Obamacare, What's In It For Me, What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act, and Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Wendell Potter joins us on the phone right now. Wendell, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Thank you, Rob.
So I want to ask you about this provision in the Senate tax plan to repeal Obamacare. What do you think about it?
Well, it would repeal the individual mandate, as you've mentioned, which is a requirement that all Americans get some kind of insurance, and largely through a private insurer, of course, unless the person is eligible for Medicare or Medicaid or the VA or some other government program. What this will do, undoubtedly, is really further destabilize the individual market. It will take us back, unfortunately, to a time before the law was passed in which so many people were not able to afford coverage. It's a very controversial part of the Affordable Care Act, but it was necessary, quite frankly, to be able to continue forward and have an insurance marketplace as we have now. So it's very troubling.
So if this mandate, the individual mandate, is repealed, does that mean that the Affordable Care Act then ultimately collapses?
Not in its entirety. Most people do tend to think of the Affordable Care Act as being something that's beneficial only to those who buy coverage on their own and not have it available through their employers. But it does a lot of other important things that I hope will not go away. It does make it illegal for insurance companies to refuse to sell coverage to people because of pre-existing conditions. It requires them to spend at least 80% of what we pay in premiums on our health care. And it prohibits them from dropping people from coverage when they get sick. So there are a number of good provisions that wouldn't necessarily be affected by this. But my fear is that it will start to undermine the market so quickly that I'm sure the insurers will come back to Congress and say, this is not sustainable. You're going to have to help us out here. And we'll be pretty much back in the same boat, I'm afraid, that we were years ago.
So if it undermines the insurance markets, insurance companies will no longer be able to, just explain that a little bit more. How it would undermine the insurance markets?
Without the individual mandate, there's no requirement, of course, that people who are fairly young and healthy have to buy coverage. And that's the reason for the mandate, is to get more people into the pool, if you will, the insurance pool, so that it's not just a pool of older and less healthy people. And when you have a pool like that, clearly the premiums are extraordinarily high, and so high that some people just simply can't afford them, as was the case before the Affordable Care Act was passed. So the expectation is that a lot of people will become what has been referred to as free riders, people who do not get coverage because they think they're going to gamble on their health and think they can go another year without getting sick or injured and just take their chances. And that means that the people who are most likely to stay in the marketplace are people who know that they're going to be needing medical care. And that will lead to insurance companies raising rates on the people who remain in the marketplace. That's what is often referred to as a death spiral. And without the individual mandate, I think that we can anticipate that will happen. And we'll also undoubtedly see the reemergence of what is referred to as skinny plans, or plans with very skimpy benefits that don't cover nearly enough. And people will see these as being adequate. They often are very inadequate. So like I said before, I'm very troubled about this. And we'll just have to see what happens, of course, if this goes forward.
Here in Florida, and I think it's happening in other places around the country, is that a huge number of people are signing up now for Obamacare. They in the last few years, they didn't sign up for it. This year, the numbers are pretty big, even though the period to sign up for the Affordable Care Act has been shortened. What do you think is going on?
Well, I think it's somewhat ironic, because you're seeing a lot of confidence and support for the Affordable Care Act at a time when Congress is trying to undermine it. It seems as if the people who have signed up for 2018 will be okay. The rates that have been published will be available to people. The concern is what will happen in 2019 and going further out. And I think we'll see that a lot of people will find this time next year that the rates that insurance companies publish, that how much they'll charge for coverage in 2019 will be much higher. But people are beginning to recognize the value of the Affordable Care Act. I wish it had come earlier, but I think with all the conversation about what likely will go away, what Congress might take away from us, has prompted a lot of people to take a look at the marketplace once again and sign up, because they know that it's health insurance is very important.
Well, we're talking with Wendell Potter, who used to work for private health insurance companies. He became a whistleblower about their practices when he wrote a book called Deadly Spin. That was several years ago. Now he's become a critic of the health insurance industry, and he's also started a new investigative website called tarbill.org, and we're going to talk about that in just a moment. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. And Wendell, the Washington Post just reported a few minutes ago that in Washington, the Senate's second-ranking Republican says that the Republicans do have the votes needed to pass the tax bill in the Senate. So they're now saying that they have enough votes to do that could come today. If the mandate is part of this tax plan package, if taking away the mandate is part of the tax plan package, what do you think is going to happen after the bill goes into effect? Tell us, what you would expect to happen in the next few years.
Well, first of all, if the Senate does pass it, which it is now expected, it will have to go to conference or somehow be reconciled with the version that was passed by the House. So it will not reach the president's desk until that happens. And the Affordable Care Act had to undergo something comparable, although it got to be pretty complicated. But anyway, the bill has to be agreed to by both chambers, the same bill, and that may take a few more days. I think what will happen in the coming years is that we're going to see the consequences of this. We are going to be seeing not only will health insurance costs continue to go up, but there is not, in fact, there was not adequate incentive or nothing in the Affordable Care Act that does enough to control health care costs. It does some, but I think even those things that was kind of a deterrent on the rising health care costs will go away. So we undoubtedly are going to be seeing further increases. There's nothing that Congress is considering in terms of controlling the cost of drugs, for example. And we've seen over many years that the private market, the private health insurance industry, has been completely incapable of controlling drug costs and hospital costs. So there's this assumption by a lot of lawmakers that if you just hand over the healthcare system to the free market, that somehow things will be different. It just doesn't work that way. For anyone who really fully understands how the health insurance market works, it's very different from any other segment of the economy. So I'm very troubled about this. I keep saying that, but I think that we may and likely will go through a period of time of testing to see how the free market can actually perform and what the consequences are. I'm not an optimist, quite frankly.
Before Obamacare was passed, a lot of people were hoping that President Obama would try to impose or rather try to get a single-payer bill passed through Congress. He decided not to do that. For those folks that want single-payer, is there any hope that, from your point of view, that single-payer might be achieved in the U.S.?
I do think so. I think it's actually inevitable.
This is a weekly test of the emergency alert system. WMNF is testing equipment that can quickly warn you in the event of an emergency. This is 88.5 WMNF HD Tampa, Community Conscious Radio. This concludes this test of the emergency alert system.
Senator Bernie Sanders introduced his Medicare for All bill in September. It was a surprise to see how many co-sponsors he had on the bill. More than a dozen, I think 18 co-sponsors, which is really quite remarkable. We haven't seen that in the past. And we've seen a lot of polls lately that show a really resurgence in support for a single-payer healthcare system. People are beginning to catch on and realize, as I've been saying, that the so-called free market just doesn't deliver on controlling costs or getting us universal coverage, and it never will.
So for folks that would like to see a single-payer system, knowing that the Republicans don't, there's not one Republican co-sponsor of that Bernie Sanders single-payer bill, and never has been when John Conyers or the congressman from Washington State, who I'm forgetting right now, Jim McDermott, right, were pushing single payer over the last 20 or 25 years. No Republican ever signed on to that. For folks that would like to, you know, renew that effort, what would you say to them? What's the best first step?
Well, I think it's activism. It's helping people understand that this is not a pipe dream. It is entirely achievable, but it's going to take a lot of people working collectively and individually to make it happen. You're right. Over many years, legislation has been introduced, certainly on the House side, that has never gone anywhere. And I don't think that there's any expectation that Senator Sanders' bill will go anywhere during the current session of Congress, which goes through next year. After 2018, I think that we may see some changes. A lot of the Democrats who are apparently interested in running for president have signed on to single-payer health care. So I think we're going to see that become more mainstream than we've ever seen before in terms of support for it. And that is, again, because of just the failure of the free market to get us where we need to be. We spend more than $3 trillion on health care in this country, far more per capita, too, than any other country in the world. And we have so little to show for it.
You used to work for Humana, and then you worked for Cigna. Do health insurance companies contribute anything to the health of the people of the U.S.?
You know, I came to the conclusion, no. What I learned in my 20 years working for those big companies and working in the industry broadly is that these companies, the thing they know how to do best is make money and enhance shareholder value. That was one of my top job responsibilities, was to do what I could to enhance shareholder value. So our number one constituency was our investors. That's what you try to do, and you try to do everything you can to make sure that investors are happy, that your profit margins are maintained, and that your stock price continues to go up. That's beneficial not just for the shareholders, but for the senior executives of the company. And that's why there is no incentive from the inside of the industry to change things radically. That's why I left my job, because I knew that if there was to be fundamental change, it had to come from outside. One of the things, by the way, my former CEO said that kept him up at night was someday there would be a reckoning, a realization, particularly by business leaders, that the private insurance companies don't add value. They would begin to question their value proposition, use the term that's often used in business, and that he felt that insurance companies could be disintermediated, which is the term that is used to describe what happens to a middleman like the insurance industry. Other countries don't have the same kind of system, so we can look for plenty of evidence that insurance companies, as we have them here, are just simply not necessary.
Our guest is Wendell Potter. He is a former official within two giant insurance companies. He's written several books. He's become a whistleblower about those health insurance companies. Those books include Deadly Spin and Nation on the Take. And our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Linda in St. Petersburg. Hi, Linda. Thanks for calling in. What's your question for Wendell Potter?
Hi. Thank you. And thank you for the show. It's so important. I've called you before and regarding insurance issues, and I just would like to be an example. I am an activist. I've become my own health care advocate over the past few months. I've had cancer that I'm aware of since June, and I've been through two major health care companies and seven primary care physicians. And what has happened was they started to delay my treatment. I mean, everything took way too long. It took weeks to get an appointment with a primary care physician. It took weeks to get radiology. I already knew I had cancer, and I went there yelling at them, you know, you've got to help me now. I don't have time to screw around with all of this. And the bottom line, and the last doctor that I had gone to was the best. I fought with the health care insurance company, which is the only five-star company in the state of Florida. And I fought with them for two months. And I finally got them to agree to send me to the Moffitt Cancer Center here in Tampa area. And everything was good. But I went to get a primary care, which I have to have under the Obama plan, right? You had to have a primary care for an HMO. Well, the HMO doctors won't take me because I'm at Moffitt now. And because I'm at Moffitt, it gives them the right not to treat me. Mm. I was told by the last doctor, flat out, Linda, you know, you can cancel that surgery because you're not going there. And I said, what do you mean? It took me months to get into Moffitt for my surgery. And he said, well, you have to go to our doctors in our network. And so what's happening is they're becoming like mini mafia corporations, these doctors. They're not individual doctors anymore. They're the deliverers of insurance and issues, and they don't want to treat you. And I think that is their sole purpose, is to people like me who are seriously ill, they're going to let us go by the wayside. That's all I got to say. And that is the truth. I feel as though they intentionally put roadblocks in the way of my getting care. Mm-hmm. And I feel that very strongly.
Linda, could you tell us which insurance company you're with?
Optimum.
Okay.
And they were sued recently for $32 million because they weren't providing the care. It was a Medicare fraud situation. You can look it up. It's real.
All right, Linda, thanks a lot. I hope things go better for you.
Thank you. I'm going to surgery on Tuesday.
Wow. So all right.
Oh, good luck, Linda.
Thank you.
Good luck. Good luck. Wendell, you want to comment about that?
Yeah, it's such a troubling story, and it's not isolated, unfortunately. We've been told to fear other kinds of healthcare systems because of rationing. What you've heard there with Linda's story is the insidious kind of rationing that we have in this country. And she's right. Insurance companies or our system creates roadblocks that prevent people from getting the care that they need. And in the past, before Obamacare, insurance companies frequently would drop people from coverage once they had a diagnosis of cancer. They can't do that anymore, but they can do what Linda is experiencing of delay and delay and delay and confusion. And people finding out that they can't see a doctor that's not in their network, which is just ludicrous. I don't know why Americans have put up with this system as long as we have, but it's a system that we've grown up with, the system we know, and we've been led to fear any other kind of system. And I know that because that's what I used to do for a living, was to make people afraid of alternatives.
Would you, for instance, lie as an executive in a health insurance company, would you lie, I don't know if that's too strong of a word, about Canada and waiting lines in Canada and the adequacy of care in Canada?
Yeah, absolutely. We would lie and we would mislead people. And what you do is use selective anecdotes and selective data. You can, one of my favorite courses in college, by the way, going back many years, was how to lie with statistics. And that's often what you see happening. And I've since have spent quite a bit of time in Canada to really get to understand that system. And much of what I do these days, Rob, is making amends for misleading people about the Canadian system and other systems around the world. They do a far better job of controlling costs and making sure that people get timely access to the care that they need. We've been told that people have to wait for months for needed care in Canada. It's not true. People have access to care that's needed. You might have to wait for elective procedures, as we do in this country. But there have been so many lies that have been told. And the reason they're told is because the insurance industry wants people to be afraid of change. And they know that a single-payer system would threaten their business models. That's why it happened.
Let's take another phone call. Wendell Potter is our guest. He's a former health insurance company executive. He's now become a whistleblower about the practices of health insurance companies. He's written several books on the topic, including Deadly Spin. Let's go to Dan in Tampa. Dan, you're on with Wendell Potter. What's your question?
Hey, well, it was kind of a comment and more than a question. It's funny because you're talking about controlling costs. I was talking to a lady yesterday, and she just happened to run across a bill for her daughter when she had her appendix taken out, and it was in 1961 or so, she said. The total bill from the hospital for the operation and everything was $123.
Mm.
So back then, you can take that same operation today, and what I'm trying to say is back then, most people, not everybody, probably made about that much money in a week. So they could pay that whole bill with 1 week's salary. You couldn't come close to that today with that same operation.
Not at all.
In most cases, for most people.
Yeah. All right.
Absolutely.
Dan, thank you.
Furthermore, the industry, particularly the pharmaceuticals, they're not interested in helping or having health care. Because an example of that would be the hepatitis C thing. They can basically cure that disease if they wanted to. It's like you got a 98.7% of curability. In America, it costs enormous amounts of money to take this pill, $1,000 or more per pill. So what they do is they don't want people to get well. They keep perpetuating the problem by having people get infected by having sexual intercourse with others. And the next person gets hepatitis C. So they have a continuous clientele. So we're not interested in America in helping health-wise. It seems to be all about the almighty dollar.
All right, I mean, Dan, thank you.
That's what I think, bottom line. And these doctor's offices today, I believe, are owned by corporations, a lot of them, see? You go into a primary care, and it's owned by division of whatever, and I could be wrong, maybe Mr. Potter can help, but I believe these companies go in and they tell these family doctors, look, we're going to just pay you $200,000 a year, and we're running this office, and we're going to tell you what we're going to be charging and so forth and so on.
All right. Well, Dan, we're going to get Wendell
really
Potter's insights on this.
Yeah.
Dan, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call. We're going to get Wendell's insights in this. Dan, a lot of people tell me, they who are libertarians, say, I want to go back to a fee-for-service system, like Dan was talking about, and that is that you pay $130 or so for your appendectomy. Is it possible to go back to just having fee-for-service, or why do you think costs have gone up so sharply in the last 60 years or so?
No, we can't go back. Only the super wealthy would be able to get care these days under a system that libertarians often propose and think that we could go back to. It's because the costs have gone so high. The reason they've gotten so high is a symbiotic relationship between insurance companies and hospital companies, physicians, medical device manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies. They're all dependent on each other for revenue and for profits, and collectively they've got a good thing going. They point the fingers at each other away from them as to the culprits for rising healthcare costs, but it's with a wink because they all know that the system as it is very, very profitable for the entrenched special interests, whether we're talking about insurance companies or hospitals or, and Dan is correct. And we've seen the corporatization of medicine to the extent that a lot of physician practices are owned either by hospitals or by corporations, practice management companies, or hedge funds. So it's all about the dollar, the almighty dollar, as Dan said. And if we try to go back to a system in which it's entirely upon everyone to have enough money to pay for the care that they need on a fee-for-service basis, we would see that, again, only the super wealthy would be able to afford care because of the way that healthcare is priced these days.
You said Canada was able to control costs. Does Canada have these kind of arrangements that you're talking about, these interconnected relationships that you just mentioned?
No, well, absolutely not. Yeah. And that's why over the course of the last 50 years since the Canadian system has developed, they've been able to control costs. You can get private coverage in most countries that have universal coverage and a government-run healthcare system, but usually it is for supplemental policies and for things that aren't covered in a basic plan. And in dental care, for example, in Canada, you can get private coverage for dental care, but there is no need for people to spend ever increasing amounts of money every year in premiums to a private insurance company for coverage. It's just not known there and in most other countries around the world.
I want to move on to my next guest, Wendell, but I want to ask you about Tarbell. You have started an investigative website. Tell us about Tarbell.
Tarbell is a nonprofit investigative journalism website that seeks to hold these big corporations accountable, whether we're talking again about insurance companies or drug companies or hospital companies. It's going to be focusing on money and politics, certainly, and how big corporations and billionaires are able to call the shots in Washington, as we are seeing today, as we talked about earlier. This tax plan that's going forward is something that the very wealthy in this country want. And most Americans now don't because they understand what's happening. We're going to be focusing on holding the real powers that be in this country more accountable. But we're also going to be investigating solutions. We don't want to just leave people in despair. We want to help people understand how things can be better. And we'll be reporting on how systems in Canada and the UK and France and Germany and Japan and other places, how they operate and how they're able to achieve what they've achieved at such a lower cost than we have.
And so they can
go to tarbell.org. As I said, it's nonprofit. We're reader funded. We're not going to be accepting advertising.
And Ida Tarbell was one of the great muckraking journalists from about a century ago.
That's right. Her reporting was focused also on the robber barons of her era, and her reporting led to the breakup of the biggest monopoly of her day, the the Standard Oil Company, and to very important antitrust and campaign finance legislation. We want to follow her lead, and she's our guiding spirit.
Wendell Potter, so great to have you here. Thanks a lot for coming on WMNF, and we hope to have you back soon.
Thank you, Rob. My pleasure.
All right. Wendell Potter, who is the author of several books, including Nation on the Take and Deadly Spin, and his new organization is Tarbell, TARBELL.org. Well, we've been talking about the Senate vote to change the nature of the tax system in the U.S., and we're going to continue with that. We're going to change focus right now and look at the impact of the Republican tax plan on Medicare and Social Security. And for that, we're going to go to Max Richman from the Committee to Protect Social Security and Medicare. He's on with us live. Max, welcome back to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Good morning. Thanks for the invitation.
It looks like the Senate is going to pass this tax plan. What will the tax plan do for Medicare and Social Security?
Well, we know that the immediate impact on Medicare, because of the rules of the Senate, something called PAYGO, the resulting increase in the federal deficit will require an immediate fiscal year $25 billion cut in the Medicare program. This is going to be probably borne by providers, doctors, and other providers to Medicare beneficiaries. The problem with it essentially is that it's going to restrict services. We may see doctors that decide not to accept Medicare assignment. It will trickle down to a negative impact on Medicare beneficiaries. But larger than that, I read yesterday that Senator Rubio, in an interview, made clear what's probably one of the worst-kept secrets in Washington is this resulting enormous deficit is going to open the door for additional cuts to Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid. He said what we've all been thinking for the last couple of months as this tax legislation has worked its way through the Congress.
So let me get this straight. So because this tax bill will blow a hole in the deficit, and because we have limits on how much deficit spending we can do under this pay-as-you-go rule up there in Congress, that they're going to have to cut other programs in order to try to keep under the spending limits that they've imposed on themselves?
Well, you know, what we're going to see is kind of a repeat of what happened when President Bush took over in 2001. If you recall, back then we were on the path to surpluses, not deficits, surpluses as far as the eye could see. And I remember economists, well-respected economists in D.C. saying, well, what are we going to do with all these surpluses? Well, that changed pretty dramatically in the first few years of President Bush entering office when we had deficits grow enormously, very quickly. And the way out of that situation was cutting Social Security, privatizing Social Security. You'll remember that. That was his main objective as he entered his second term. He said he had earned political capital. He was going to privatize Social Security. So what is going to happen? What Senator Rubio made plain in the interview, I believe it was yesterday, is while all of these deficit hawks that have been decrying budget deficits for decades are going to let this slide through, this tax bill, which blows, as you just said, a huge hole in the deficit and the debt, they're letting it go through, but we're going to see very quickly some of the commitments that the Speaker has made and so many Republicans in the House and the Senate over time that we need to cut and programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and they're going to be reinforced in that logic by looking at the huge deficit that they're overlooking right now. Their goal right now is to pass any bill. They want a notch of victory. And they're going to do that. It looks like they're going to do that today. And then it'll go back over to the House. There'll be different. There are differences in the House and Senate bill. It's not over by a long shot, but they're moving forward. That's pretty clear.
If the Senate passes the bill today, the House and Senate versions of the bill have to be reconciled. Will there be another vote after this today?
There will have to be another vote because two things can happen. The House can, and this would be probably the worst case scenario, the House can just, if they have the votes, can take up the Senate bill and pass it, and then it goes on to the president. That'll be the last vote that happens. There are members of the House that won't be able to live with some of the things that are in the Senate bill. So if that holds, there'll be a conference between the House and the Senate conferees, which will be mostly the Finance Committee and Budget Committee members. And then a compromise will be developed, and that will have to be voted on again by the House and again by the Senate. So those are the two alternatives that we're looking at right now.
We're talking with Max Richmond, who is with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. He's based in Washington, D.C. He's worked on this issue for decades. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. I don't understand, though, why if under pay as you go, if there's a threat of increasing the deficit, that they would go after Medicare. Couldn't they go after other programs and cut Medicare?
They will go after other programs. The PAYGO, the 2010 PAYGO Act, requires certain reductions in programs, and it's not just it isn't just Medicare, but it does include Medicare. It includes other mandatory programs that are subject to this reduction, including agriculture subsidies, student loans, social service block grants, other mandatory spending, including some of the Medicaid expansion. So it's not just Social Security, but you know we're the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. So what we're focusing on at this point is the PAYGO sequester, as it is called, will do to the Medicare program. And in terms of Medicare, it's subject to the sequester. There's a limit on the reduction to Medicare. This is all statutory. It's not something that anybody would have to do proactively. It would happen automatically. And that reduction is 4%. And that's on top of a 2% reduction that is already in effect because of other budget control acts kicking in. So this is really an automatic pilot. Now, it can be turned around. The Congress could try to pass legislation to waive this PAYGO requirement. It's not clear that they will do so. And it's not clear, even if the leadership in the Congress wants to do that, that the votes would be there.
All right. So if the Medicare is one of the programs likely to be cut, there's a 4% cap on that. So is that $25 billion that would be cut in the
That's
first
the
year?
That's the $25 billion. All 4% right. cap would be $25 billion. It's my understanding that would be placed on providers, not on increased premiums or deductibles or co-pays by beneficiaries. It would be paid on providers, and those providers would in turn have to figure out how are we going to absorb that? Are we going to cut back on the number of Medicare patients or maybe just decide not to accept assignment and not treat Medicare patients? It's going to play out in a negative way on Medicare beneficiaries. But keep in mind that this tax legislation, the framework of it was set up by the budget resolution, which sets up the process we're in now, which is the Reconciliation Act. And that budget resolution in both the House and the Senate call for almost $500 billion in cuts to the Medicare program over the next 10 years, and over $1 trillion to the Medicaid program. And the Congress is going to have to figure out how to make that happen. But these are dramatic. This is the $25 billion is immediate, unless the Congress waives that. But the overall reductions over 10 years that are in the budget resolution that is the basis for this reconciliation bill are much more severe and go beyond Medicare. They don't go to Social Security. That's a separate law that requires 60 votes to make any changes to Social Security. So it cannot be done in this piece of legislation. Medicaid, on the other hand, will have a dramatic reduction, almost $1 trillion in federal support for the Medicaid program, and that is going to have serious consequences for nursing home residents. 62% of nursing home costs are paid for by Medicaid. And who's in nursing homes? Seniors, disabled, children. They're going to feel this very, very quickly and continuing over the next 10 years in terms of services that that the Medicaid program is paying for, not only nursing homes, but home care and community and home-based care.
Well, we're talking with Max Richmond, who is the executive director of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the tax bill that the Senate is just about to pass. Max, I was surprised how little discussion there's been on the impact on Medicare if this tax bill passes. I haven't heard much. Maybe I haven't been paying attention in the right quarters. But, I mean, this is a pretty big deal, especially because we're here in Florida, and this is the Tampa, St. Pete, Sarasota, Bradenton, Clearwater, Lakeland, Winter Haven area. Lots of seniors live here. Why do you think there's been so little discussion?
Well, I'm talking about it to you right now.
Yeah.
But there's been plenty of discussion. So many of the advocacy groups, including ours, the Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, have been involved in press conferences. I have with the Senate. I've testified before. Wasn't an official hearing because Democrats can't call one since they're in the minority.
There's been no hearing on this tax bill.
No hearing. Yeah, exactly. And you know what's a little surprising is I know Senator McCain, who's been really good on issues involving seniors, made such a point in the Affordable Care Act that we should have regular order, we should have hearings, some of the advocacy groups that are impacted have a chance to put out their positions, but apparently he doesn't feel that that's something that applies to this tax bill, because there's been no regular order. There's been no hearings. There have been committee, finance committee, budget committee called markups, sessions to just put together a package of amendments and put out a bill. But, you know, the reason for all this is pretty clear. The more people find out about this, the less they like it. All the polling over the last few years shows overwhelming support for not just protecting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and not just by Democrats, but by Republicans as well, including in Florida. This is a bill that is more interested in fulfilling a campaign promise, assuring the donor community that they're going to be rewarded, and it's not focused on people, and that's really sad.
Max, you've worked in Washington, D.C. a long time. Why would the Republicans vote for something that, at least according to the polls, isn't very popular? And some of the people that are going to get hurt, in fact, many of the people are going to get hurt, are the same people who voted for Donald Trump.
I know. I can't explain it. Those same people who voted for Donald Trump, who voted for Senator Rubio and others, this is going to be a strict party line vote. There'll be no I don't think there'll be a single Democrat voting for this, and almost all the Republicans will, maybe one or two will not. Those citizens that elected these members of the Congress, House and Senate, and President Trump, it looks like they voted against their own best interests, and we're going to have to see what the blowback is. come November of 2018.
Well, Max Richmond of the National Committee to Preserve and Social Security and Medicare, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
I appreciate the opportunity. You have a good day.
All right. Thanks, Max. Bye-bye. All right. So there's Max Richmond. You can find him at ncpssm.org. That's the abbreviation for National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, ncpssm.org, Max Richmond. Well, let's open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. The great Patty Perkey is back answering phones. So is the wonderful Frank Knox. So we're going to take your phone calls, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Dave in Sarasota. Dave, you're on. What would you like to comment about?
Yeah, I'd like to say thanks, WNF, for this program, and you had two great guests today. I think Max forgot to mention that they're probably going to be raiding the Medicaid and Medicare trust funds in order when they don't see that they got enough revenues coming in. And also, they would probably be trying to raise the age of Medicare eligibility and Social Security. And the other comment I wanted to make was that he gave us a good reason not to vote for Marco Rubio of his plan for trying to get Social Security privatized. Now, the one question I kind of had was they say that these things are tax cuts are permanent. Is that truly possible or whatever?
The tax cuts for the corporations are permanent. The tax cuts for individuals are not permanent.
Right. Okay.
Well, all right, Dave. Thanks
for
a lot.
Great show.
All right. Thank you for saying that. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Steve in Sarasota. Hi, Steve. You're on. What would you like to say?
Yeah, I was trying to get Max before you lost him, but I was kind of hoping I could ask my question. But anyhow, I just don't understand why the Democrats just don't say, listen, we are not going to vote on any bill you give to us unless, you know, there's some hearings and some people get some opinions on it, you know, to make it the best for everybody. But, I guess that's not going to happen. So I don't know if Max had a view on that or...
Yeah, you know, I should have asked him that. I suspect that what he would say is that even if they didn't show up for the vote, the Republicans would still win on this tax bill.
Yeah. I had talked to you before about Obamacare. I am an Obamacare, we'll call it recipient. I do have a plan that I got through healthcare.gov. I just got my renew yesterday for my plan. My plan personally went up for my cost $20 a month. Okay? My plan personally went up $20 a month. So I'm paying from $62.88 a month to $82.80 a month, which is a phenomenal amount. I don't mind paying for the health care. My subsidy went from $509 a month to $851 a month. So I don't know. I got my little kid. I'm a truck driver. I'm on the road, but I don't know what that percentage of increase is for the subsidy compared to my monthly payment. But I'm just wondering how they determine that, you know, for the increase in the policy.
I don't know. We're planning to get an expert on Obamacare back. She's been on several times. We're going to try to get her on in the next few days. So when we do, I hope you'll ask the question.
Yeah, I was trying to crunch the numbers. Actually, the policy that I have changed a little bit. My out-of-pocket actually went down $150. So I have a max out-of-pocket of $2,000 and deductible $2,000. So that went down to $1,850. But for the $20 a month more I pay, you know, it's $240 more a year for the same policy. But I had a few little adjustments. I just wanted to, you know, touch base on that. If anybody else had got their renew and find out, you know, how much their increase was and how they determined the difference in the subsidy and what it's got to be 30 at least. Off the top, I had 30-35% increase.
Yeah. So, but you're pretty happy though overall with.
Well, overall, I'm happy. I mean, like I said, I don't mind paying for decent insurance, and I'm a 60-year-old man who, you know, I'm in that group where, you know, we're the ones that are going to get screwed no matter what. You know, I'm a 60-year-old man that makes you know, $26,000 a year. I mean, you know, how do you justify the expense later on?
Yeah.
I'm just hoping to make it to 66 before the health care with the subsidy. So expensive.
Make it to Medicare. All right. Steve, thanks a lot. Drive safely there. All right, buddy. Thanks a lot. 813-239-9663. Chip writes this. Single payer would provide an immediate boost to the U.S. economy and has been proven by the rest of the world to be far superior to our healthcare system. But if we don't significantly improve our overall health, wouldn't healthcare costs in a single payer system eventually become as unaffordable as they are now? That's Chip in Tampa. I think the numbers still are pretty much this. And I got these years ago from the Johns Hopkins University study of comparing a nation like Canada, which has a single-payer system, in which everybody, 100% of citizens, are covered. And there are no deductibles. Their overall cost per capita in Canada is about, and we'll have to go to the Johns Hopkins website to find these numbers, about $4,000 per person. And that covers everything. In the U.S., our per capita healthcare costs are somewhere around $8,500. And I could be off, but I'm not off by much, I promise. So in Canada, you're going to find a lot of heavy-set people. I don't know I think we all should take care of ourselves and not smoke and not drink to excess and not eat to excess. And try to cut down on carbohydrates, but I don't think it's not the big factor. I think in our healthcare system is that so much is skimmed off the top by insurance companies. I think that's the big factor in our costs here. Rick writes this: isn't Lindsey Graham who said if we don't give them this, the donors won't take our phone calls? Yeah, I think the donors are putting a pressure on the Republicans in Congress to pass this tax bill. Steve in Sarasota, thanks a lot for calling. Let's go to Rob in Lutz. Rob, you're on. What would you like to say?
Yes, good morning. Thank you for having Mr. Richmond and Mr. Potter on. Going back to Mr. Potter and that poor lady Linda who called in with her cancer and with Optimum Healthcare, so-called five-star rated HMO here in Florida. I'm 73, and I urge everybody to, in the next 3 days, make up your mind quick because open enrollment closes on Thursday for Medicare. Sign up. And I signed up with Optimum, and then I heard from my primary care physician, Rob, that company is being sold this year. So, quick as I could, I called up and got back on my Humana plan, which is much better anyway. But I thought maybe because of their subsidies and their extra contribution to the Part B rebate, it would be better, but it's not. And it was all wrong. So I'm going back to Humana. But the whole thing is, it's one hand washes another. And Mr. Richmond and Mr. Potter pointed it out perfectly. It's all about the donor community and what they can get out of it. They don't even care about votes anymore. It's a hideous situation, so be very, very careful.
All right, Rob, thanks a lot. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Elizabeth in Riverview. Hi, Elizabeth, you're on. What would you like to say?
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate the time. I called in early, and I was, before the gentleman spoke about the single payer, the Medicare for All, that is something I think is just ought to be nationally taken care of, and obviously Congress isn't too interested in voting for it. The only thing I can suggest for we people who have obviously been not paying enough attention to what these people in Congress are doing, I think perhaps we read something about them when they are running for office and we think, okay, that's good. But then we don't keep up with it. I haven't paid that much attention, but just the other day I got a lovely big envelope with a ask for a donation, of course, but there is a letter in there from Bernie Sanders, too. This is something he, of course, doesn't subsidize. He supports this public citizen, which is pushing for the single-payer insurance. Another thing, is it time for us to force someone to put time limits on these senators? This Conyers, who is obviously over the hill.
Yeah, he's been there a long time. Elizabeth, well, we're out of time. Sorry about
all
that.
Right,
all right. All right. Have a great weekend. Daniel Ruth is coming up next. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. If you want to comment about today's show, call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play your comments back Monday morning at 11.